Hey, listener, do you ever buy a wine because it has a 95-point score? Should you buy a wine just because it has a 95-point score? What if a wine has a low score? Or no score at all? And what do these scores mean, anyway? We'll tackle that today with someone whose job it was to publish scores for a major wine magazine. This is the Inside Wine Podcast. I'm Joe Janisch, a certified specialist of wine and wine industry professional since 1996, giving you insider tips to make the right wine decisions. Today's guest is one of my really good friends, somebody I've known since I started in the wine industry way back in the days of the pterodactyls and T-Rex. His name is William Tischerman. He goes by the pen name of W.R. Tisch, although us folks in the industry know him as simply Tisch. And Tisch has been in the wine business again for a little longer than I have, believe it or not. And Tisch fell into the wine industry when he was moonlighting as a proofreader for a now defunct magazine called Les Amis du Vin, which was a French wine magazine. And he did that while he was earning a degree in creative writing. And he kind of parlayed that into a gig at Wine Enthusiast magazine when it was just launching back in 1988. At Wine Enthusiast, he was the executive editor, and that was at the height of the ratings golden age, which was the 1990s, when many wine publications followed the lead of Robert Parker and began putting scores on wines. So he has some very interesting insight into this whole scores and ratings things, and that's why we are talking to him today. Without further ado, Tisch, thank you for joining us on the Inside Wine Podcast.
So today, apparently, we're talking about an antique topic that people rarely actually speak of directly. It's wine ratings. It's the Voldemort of the wine industry.
The Voldemort. Oh, I like that.
Nobody speaks its name. But actually, it's because nobody really cares anymore, I think.
You know, you would say that. So, you know, Tisch, the big reason that I'm having you on today is because there are so many people, and I'm sure our listener is one of them, who go into the wine shop and they see these numbers all over the wine shelves. They see these stickers on the bottles. It says 91, 96, 95, 92. And I, you know, there are people that actually pick up the bottle because of those numbers, but you know, you have some experience here. Does it make any sense for someone to where did this even come from? Maybe that's where we should start, Tisch. Is like, where did this even come from with the whole numbers on the bottles and on the shelf talkers things? Where did that start?
It probably started when you were about 11, Joe. but yeah, it's a good question, and there actually is an origin. There was an origin point, and I think it all leads back to Robert Parker becoming popularized, which was the late 80s. On the power of the quote-unquote fantastic 1982 vintage. And it was a time when people were very interested in wine, and there was so much wine, maybe too much wine. There always is too much wine. And it caught traction, Robert Parker, and the 90-point system was sort of born in the late 80s and hit its golden era in the 1990s when other media started using the same system, and consumers naturally flocked to it because we are Americans and we love two things, Joe. We love guidance. We do like getting the good stuff, but we love guidance and we love shortcuts.
Right.
And we all went to school. And what do you get in school when you get grades? Sometimes you get grades on the 100-point scale. And if you got a 90, what was it?
It was an A. Yeah. It was an A.
It was an A.
Were there any other ratings before the 100 points? No, really. Like the,
you know, seriously. Well, the English system that was in use at the time and most popular was probably the 20-point scale, which was actually grounded in academia, and it was based on a rubric, not just sort of a Rubik's cube.
An
opinion. That would have been. That's a new system. Wow, stop everything. The Rubik's Cube system of wine. Spin it. But yeah, they used the 20-point scale, and there were stars that were being used by some people, and there were some people who simply wrote tasting notes of the, quote, you know, the most important wines, the ones that people would have collected back then. But everything sort of like blew up in the 90s because wine itself blew up, So the volume of the so what I like to call the wine universe just exploded and expanded, and everybody wanted to keep up. So consumers wanted those ratings to help keep up, and retailers fueled it by using those, you know, whether it was Parker or Spectator or Wine and Spirits or the Enthusiast, anyone, retailers were able to use it and point to it as an independent third party validation of good wine. So they were all for it too. And then it kind of just got out of control because too many numbers and great inflation, et cetera.
Yeah.
Is the rest history yet, Joe? Are we done with numbers?
I don't.
Have you heard, seriously, have you heard anyone say within the past year or so, did you see that Duckhorn Merlot got an 89?
You know, yes, believe it or not. But the thing is, I'm so, in, you know, it's part of my job. I'm a public relations director, and it is actually one of the most important things in my job is to make sure that every wine that we have gets a score from somewhere.
You're working the system as you should, but it is now a system, and the ratings are sort of existing in a cloud where people like you can use them, people who want to get them, find them on Vivino. They find them on the websites of wineries. They find them on Vivino. They find them if they actually subscribe to a magazine, which they don't anymore. They would find the numbers and use them. So the system is kind of still being used, but is it considered of great value that people put, you know, stock into now? It's more like a reference point at the point of sale, like you say, if people are in a store. But I, at some point, Joe, we got to talk about that store, because if the store is putting numbers all over its shelves now, I think that they are missing the current boat, which is to be more hands-on and independent and an advocate for their own palates. But that's another topic.
Yeah, and maybe we will even get into that today. But you know, I do go into wine retail shops, and I can tell you for sure, if I go into like a Total Wine or a Costco or some of these bigger stores, the stickers are on the bottles. There are definitely, like, almost every wine has something that indicates what the number is.
Yeah. And on websites too, if you go on wine.com, you will see reference point. You'll see actually there's like a key to the abbreviations for your Wine and Spirits, Wine Spectator, Parker, whatever. You'll see those on wine on websites too. I see how you're using them. You need to have your best scores out there so that when people want to reference them, they can. But then are they being used as anything but reference points now?
Well, here's the thing. From my standpoint, I work for an importer, which means that we're not selling directly to a consumer. We have to, our first customer is the distributor. So there are distributors who will not get behind a product or even buy a product unless it has a certain score, or they'll go sour on it and say, oh, well, we can't sell that wine if it's only 85 points or only 84 points, which remarkably, if you read a lot of the guidelines of some of these wine scoring publications, they tell you that over 80 means it's a good wine. It's not like it's a B, right? It's a B, B minus, right. B plus, like,
yeah.
But for whatever reason, it's like, so I don't, you know, we have to provide that to get through the gatekeepers, the middle people, before they can even get to the retail. And there are retailers that will only buy wines that are 90 or above. But then when it gets down to the consumer, I don't know. I think that's the question, because should our listener care if there's a number on the bottle? And I think that's what we want to get to the heart of today.
Okay. I think they should care if they have found that it actually works for them, by whatever means they use. If they think that their choices of wines correspond with what Wine Spectator thinks is a good wine, then that may be the way they choose between two Malbecs at the store. Maybe they do. So I think it still has some utility. It's always been a way of helping people get to what they want, but I think it's a more of a false shortcut now than it used to be, because nowadays I think there is a better shortcut. If the ultimate reason for ratings was to give people a shortcut to good wines, today the digital tools in their palm are even greater. They can drill down if they want. They can look into the internet for information that they never had access to before. And again, I think the ratings are sort of, they're there, they're kind of existing, but they are just sort of like pinpricks on this big database of wine information now.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned before how it all started, and you know, speaking to you, it's even more interesting to me because you started at a wine magazine right at the start of all this when all the scores were happening, and you mentioned Robert Parker. And correct me if I'm wrong, because as you said, I was only about 11 back then. But Robert Parker, who is not the fiction writer who wrote the horse books, he was a lawyer, from what I recall. He was a lawyer who was a wine fiend and started his own newsletter. But long story longer, Robert Parker rated the wines based on what he thought of the wines.
Right. Well, I was getting a sort of speeding up history. Back when Parker did it initially, it was Robert Parker rating all the wines. It was his score. And people refer to his RP ratings sometimes. And Wine Spectator, back in the day, as well as Wine Enthusiasts, were trying to do panels in many cases. And at least at Wine Enthusiasts, we were trying to do panels and still coming up with numbers however we could. We started with stars, moved to numbers. But that question what you bring up there of it's one guy's rating is at the crux of the whole just conceptual issue of, do you follow ratings? If you're following ratings, are you following one person's palate, or are you getting a panel, or are you getting what is being pitched to you by a retailer as whoever's best score attached to that wine, which became, I think, the downfall in the late 90s, because if you have the Enthusiast, if you have the Spectator, Wine and Spirits, Wine News, Parker, and a lot of other newsletter people and bloggers, if they're all throwing numbers out there, great inflation is going to happen and the cherry picking is going to happen. And next thing you know, it's all diluted. And it takes a few years, but boy, we've had a few years now and it has been diluted. We're still, I think, haven't replaced the ratings with anything until recently, because of all the Vivinos and the digital tools we have. At least people have that shortcut now, as ever, however they want to use it. And if some people are still using ratings, that's great. But I see a lot of retailers, the smart ones, the small ones, are proactively, consciously going away from ratings, and it's sort of a point of distinction. Have you found that as a PR person?
You know, I'm too far away from it.
Got to go shopping at these small stores. They have to. This is their point of distinction, that they've edited down the universe of wine and picked the good stuff without having to listen to a critic.
Yeah, and more toward the whole Robert Parker thing, there's been some criticism, and there was even an entire book about it, how many wineries actually change the way they make the wine in order to appeal to essentially one person's palate.
Yes, that was a scary time. I think we're past it, though.
I think so, too.
But the phenomenon that you speak of is real, and if not necessarily, you know, subversive or deceitful, there was an overarching feeling that wine styles were going toward that quote-unquote international style of fruit forward and, you know, impressing with it initial impact, and some people refer to it as jammy styles, and I don't know if we can really trace all that back to Robert Parker, but I think we do owe him a measure of gratitude for making the industry realize that they're going to be accountable to people who will call them out when they make bad wine. But fortunately, they're mostly making really good wine now, and everything is decent and well-made and hygienic. And as a result, pretty much everything is now above average and 90 or not. It's 90 or not, Joe. We live in that world now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's 90 or not. And you know, you just brought up something else that I remember pretty distinctly. I first came into the wine business in 1996. And I remember even then there were still some wines that weren't great. The technology has changed, you know, dramatically over the last 25, 30 years. It's almost impossible to make a bad or flawed wine. Like,
yeah, they've managed to, the product has evolved. The industry has evolved. We are in sort of like a golden age of availability of wine from around the world coming to the US, and it's good quality. And the good stuff is the stuff that wants to get here and manages to get here too.
Yeah.
It's good. It's good stuff now.
There's really good wine out there. And so when people see a score on a wine, like the number one thing they should be thinking about is that it's almost certainly the score according to one person's palate.
Absolutely.
And actually, even when it says like Wine Spectator 91, Wine Spectator 88, those could be two different critics. They have different people tasting different types of wines. So you have to do a little homework and say, all right, it turns out that if Bruce Sanderson at Wine Spectator scores this a 92, it turns out I like those wines too. I must have a similar palate to his.
Right. Well, in their defense, they keep their palate, their critics on the same beat. So if you do find that you get if there's a 94 point Primitivo that you liked, that Spectator scored 92 or 94 points, and you see another Italian wine that has a high rating from Spectator, you can be pretty much assured it's the same person, even if you don't know who it is.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think they do a pretty good job. But at the same time, even though someone at Spectator scores something a 92, if another writer scores a different wine from a different region a 92, you may not like that other wine that scored a 92. And that's where it gets tricky, right?
Absolutely true. Yeah, it does get tricky. And if you really care, and if you're really, or if you're smart, or if you care, or if you have the inclination, you just have to step a little bit past that. And in the old days, that meant reading a tasting note. Whoa, he says it's a 92. Well, maybe, what does he mean by that? And, you know, you could read the tasting note maybe. Sometimes they even paste it up in the store, a piece of paper. But now I think you can go look further using a Vivino or a Googling something, or gads, speaking to a wine merchant. What a possibility, you know?
We're going to get there in just a minute. But because you bring up the Vivino, and you can go from listening to one person's palate or one person's interpretation of what a wine is and how they've decided to make something subjective, objective. And then you go to the other way, which is, you know, like Vivino is kind of like the Yelp of wine, right? Like,
yeah, it's a crowdsource. You can go right to the crowdsource. If you don't want to trust one expert, you can trust your herd of peers.
Which is a whole nother mess, which doesn't really help you either, right? I mean,
well, it does or it doesn't. If, you know, I actually was a psychology major, Joe, way back before wine. And if you perform any behavior that gets rewarded, if you pursue a wine based on a certain recommendation and you get a wine that you like, you will pursue it again. It works for you. It is a beneficial positive reinforcement. And if the system is working for people when they use Vivino, they'll keep using it. If the system works when they walk into a store and look on the shelves for the ratings, they'll just keep using it. They'll do what still works for them. But the ratings, I think, have become sort of like these little just data points that move the dial one way or another, a little bit here and a little bit there, as opposed to a whole sort of conceptual way of viewing wine that's now in the past. And we can fortunately think about style and context and value and other good stuff other than so-and-so gave it a 93.
Right. Okay. So you've been mentioning this, and people have access and they have their phone in their hand and they can look up things right there in the store. So what is the strategy then for someone who's walking into a store? They see all these 90s all over the place. What's the strategy instead of just ignore all those scores? What do you do?
Ah, that is a really personal question, Joe.
Sometimes.
I love wine shopping, and I think it just depends on what you are trying to accomplish when you're shopping. If you have a favorite kind of wine, and you love Malbec, for example, you can use an app, or you can speak to someone, or you can just use your experience. You can look at the shelf and say, okay, I've had this, and I'm gonna try it again. Oh, it's a little too much money. Let me try one another. But, you know, that's an excellent question. And I think people shop for different wines in different ways at different times.
Okay.
I don't know if I answered your question, but.
Well, no, I understand it's a personal question, but.
But see, yeah, you see, for me personally, I will speak to somebody if I have questions, and I'll usually pose those questions in relation to specific wines. Here's the real point is, where are you looking for that wine? Are you online on a website where you can order and have it shipped? Because that impacts how you approach it, as opposed to if you're in a store and you have to walk out with something, then you're working with that edited universe. If you're looking online, you can just keep searching to your heart's content. And Joe, you know what the future of wine is?
Tell me.
The future of wine is when the internet lets you find any wine you want and get it. We're not there yet, but that at least ideal, that possibility, we're closer to that than we ever were. And what seems to be happening now also is that the websites that actually market and sell wine directly to consumers are at least trying to present that, not, I don't want to call it a fantasy, but that ideal, like, we can get that wine you want. We'll find it for you, or we'll find something that is just like it for you.
And we are definitely getting close to that. You know, there are some laws in the way right now, but we are getting there. You know, I remember, and again, this is going back a long time, the first time trying to sell wine online when it all tried to start in the late 90s, and there were so many hurdles just between technology and the laws and all kinds of issues. But I remember talking to a veteran of the wine industry, a salesman, and he's like, I don't see wine being sold online ever, because people want to, you know, walk into a store, they want to hold the bottle, they want to talk to the salesperson or the you know, the wine shop owner or whoever it is that's knowledgeable walking the floor. But you know, the thing is, I kind of bought into that, but then I realized over time that in many cases, and now I know, in, of course, you, there are many opportunities where you can like taste a wine in the store, but generally most of the wines that are in the shop, you can't just like say, hey, shop owner, can you pop open this bottle of Chambertin? I want to taste it before I buy it. You know, you can't really, you're still just relying on whatever is at your fingertips, whatever the person in front of you is saying. So I can definitely see a world where most of the wine is sold online. But again, like, we're getting a little away from the topic, but you said people want shortcuts. They want, so the score is the shortcut, but you mentioned they're like, we have other tools now. So what should a person be doing if they want to venture outside of their comfort zone, which is kind of what this podcast is all about?
I'm not sure if they want to venture outside their comfort zone or if they want to reinforce their comfort zone. Everybody in wine knows somebody who says, you know, I just don't like that kind of wine. Well, you're not going to like it. You're never going to like it. But if you know what you like, then the way you can tap into your universe of wine has never been greater. If you discover that you like a Chenin Blanc, next thing you know, you can be pursuing what Chenin Blanc can be like on the internet. And when you go shopping, you can be talking about it with the retailers. You can be reading about it online as a topic as well. I'm not sure how many people do that, but it has become, everybody can do things that they never could before in terms of trying to satisfy their own wine Jones. And I think that the ones who care about what they get are doing so. And the ones who don't care, they're satisfied to just walk into a store, look for $9.99 and walk out, and they still are happy because it's hitting their palate point as well as their price point, and the system is working. It's working without numbers, though. That's the topic I kind of think we're going around today, is that the numbers are sort of little pinpoints in the rearview mirror compared to big billboards that they used to be. But what have we replaced it with? We're sort of like encouraging people now. Maybe we are getting closer to that. Oh, everybody's got their own palate. Everybody has to find their own way. There's never been an easier time to do that. But are people doing that, or are they just drinking wine and forgetting what they had the next day?
I think that's pretty common, actually.
Yeah, I had this wine yesterday, Joe. It started with an M. Oh, Merlot. That's it. Yeah, that's it. It got 90 points from somebody.
So we're kind of establishing that scores are more or less irrelevant unless for some reason they work for you, right?
Right. It, within the context of where somebody is trying to sell or buy a wine or learn about a wine, they can still work, but they're working as reference points. And it's a tool. I mean, they were once really used, then they became abused, and now they're being used again, but I think less significantly than they were in the past.
Okay. So if you want to dig deeper into whether or not you should purchase a wine, let's use your Chenin Blanc example. You had a Chenin Blanc and you're like, wow, I enjoyed that Chenin Blanc. What are some things that, you know, a person can do to find another wine like that Chenin Blanc? And if for whatever reason, they can't remember the name of what it was, or they can't find it, or it's out of stock and they want to, you know, buy something similar because they think they might enjoy it. How are some ways they can find their way to another wine like that without using scores?
That's an excellent question. And I think that what I like to use the term wine hopscotch.
Okay.
Where if you can remember, a lot of people forget what they had and but they know they liked it. If you can remember where it's from and the grape, you're in great shape. One or the other will get you somewhere, but price point is also really important. If it was an expensive wine, you experienced something different than a cheaper wine. But if you can sort of use those reference points, and then whether you're searching online or whether you're talking to someone, those become the way you can find other wines. If you had that Chenin Blanc and it was from South Africa, if you're in the right place online or if you're speaking to the right person, they are expecting you to be talking about a sort of steely, dry Chenin Blanc. And that style is also made in the Loire Valley. It's also made sometimes in California, and you can find other examples that will please you, and then you will feel smart because you had South African Chenin Blanc and California and maybe Washington and maybe French.
Well, I had a Steen.
Yeah, a Steen. A Steen is a South African Chenin Blanc. If you could remember that, somebody will help you find another wine that will please you to no end.
Cool. That's good advice.
You know, I think we are getting toward people being able to accept that they like a wine because it was a style, not because it was necessarily a grape. Let's say you had a wine that was Chenin Blanc and you didn't remember that it was Chenin Blanc, but you still wanted to get wine similar. You could say maybe it smelled like flowers or something like that. But those kind of clues can still help you get what you want. Maybe they're not as quick a shortcut as the 90 point whatever. But yeah, it can happen, and it does.
You just hit on something that when we talk about scores and you mentioned that there are tasting notes, can a consumer trust the tasting notes?
Only if they have trusted them in the past. I've done a lot of wine tastings with groups, and there is very rarely unanimity, even on the question of is this wine dry or sweet? So you can imagine how little overlap there is in specific notes. And even people who are, you know, highly evolved tasters can both smell the same wine and say one says apple and one says pear. And they're both basically, they're in the same ballpark saying slightly different things. What I like to say is if you're not really sure of what you're smelling or tasting, you should sort of like listen to what somebody else says, and then you just add a modifier. So if they say they smell lemon, you then smell Meyer lemon. And it really impresses everyone.
How to impress your friends at the next dinner party.
And it adds like 4 points to a score.
That's great. All right. Any other tips or comments about scores?
I'll get back to and close with my vision of the future, which is, definitely, these digital tools have changed the way people get to the wine they want, and it's only going to accelerate. The whole COVID situation has put more people at home rather than out looking for wine. And where do you look for wine when you're at home? You look on the internet. And I think that websites like PixWine and wine.com and other big sites that are trying to sell wine online to people are going to be really pushing to appeal to everybody, to say you can get whatever you want and we're going to get it for you. And when that happens, I think we're sort of shaping up to have sort of a battle between David's and Goliath's, internet Goliath maybe versus like the local wine merchant who's the David, to choose the pick an analogy. And I am really a big fan of local small wine merchants because they've done all that homework to edit down the huge universe and pick what they think are really good wines. And who will, you know, who do you listen to? Do you listen to your local person who has selected that wine personally? Or do you listen to somebody over the internet who says, this is what you want?
Hmm.
It's like a devil on each shoulder, Joe. What are we going to do?
I don't know.
But the truth is, there's so much good wine out there. You're usually going to get a good wine no matter who you listen to. If you have somewhat of a good experience, ability to search in the right places for what you have thought you liked in the past, you're usually going to get a good wine. And the system is working on that level. So we're going to keep drinking more wine, I hope.
I hope so. And one last thought. If you had a wine that was 97 points and you did not like it, I think that's okay. It's just, you don't need to be ashamed. You don't need to think there's something wrong with you. It's just, again, it's just one person's opinion putting a number on a wine. And that's that.
If you can remember what that was, then you won't have that wine again. And you won't have to go through that cognitively dissonant experience again of saying, how can I be drinking a wine that's 97 and I don't like it? Well, you don't like it because it's not your 97.
Well, thank you, Tish. This was really good.
All right. I hope we all can go out and drink something good tonight and not even wonder, let alone worry about what rating it got from who. And it'll still taste good.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be 19 out of 20.
Wait, let me do the math. What's that? Is that like a 94 or 74? 84? That's like not. No. Forget it. Oh, forget it, Joe. Thank you very much for the time. I enjoyed it.
Good. Me too. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Tish, aka William Tisherman, aka WR Tish. There's more about Tish in the show notes. We'll be back again in about 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can learn more about wine at wine365.com. And remember, wine is food. It comes from a place. Enjoy it responsibly, no matter what the score is.